Blog Talk Radio. Books and authors featured on this episode of the Literary New England radio show are creating huge buzz. In Santa Montefiore's The Beekeeper's Daughter, that buzz is quite literal, as the novel tells the story of a daughter and her mother, a beekeeper, searching for love and happiness, unaware of the secrets that bind them. It splits between 1930s England and 1970s Massachusetts, and like all of Santa's novels, it's a very personal book.
I don't think I can separate myself from my characters. And there's a part of me in Trixie, and there's a part of me in Grace, and I think also sometimes there are parts of me in the men as well, in maybe their philosophies or the way they think. I put myself into everything.
I'm your host, Cindy Wolf-Boynton, and tonight I also talk with Saba Tahir on An Ember in the Ashes, the instant New York Times best-selling young adult novel about a slave, a soldier, their intertwined destinies, and their desires to be free. It's a fantasy spawned from Saba's own childhood experiences.
I felt really like an outcast. I felt like, you know, I didn't have any power as a kid. And I turned to books. As I grew, you know, I did find my power and my voice through writing. And in 2007, I decided, you know what, I want to write a book. And I didn't know, you know, what genre it would be or what it would really be about. I just knew it would be about people who felt like outcasts, like I did as a kid, and who felt like they didn't have any power or voice.
I also talk with journalist Kate Bollock about her memoir, Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. The years Kate spent as a fan of the five pioneering women writers she features in the book made her able and excited to see the parallels between their lives and her own. But that didn't mean that writing about these women or weaving their stories into her own was by any means an easy process.
I had been thinking about these women and reading their works and biographies for so long, but just as a hobbyist. So to sit down and really think about them deeply and get the facts right on the page was very hard.
We'll feature giveaways of each of these three books, but first, an excerpt of my interview with New England writer and visual artist Jacob Crane. He's the creator of a pretty terrific graphic novel called Lies in the Dust, a tale of remorse from the Salem witch trials.
Well, it's basically a story of the Salem witch trials, but kind of something that, you know, I've always wanted to do a book on the Salem witch trials, being a New England kid and being interested in stuff like that. But, you know, it's just kind of things that have been done over and over again. Your book on the Connecticut witch trials, there's only a couple of those. So I get that. But Salem was always this passion thing that I wanted to do. And I couldn't find ever a hitch, like a new story to tell that everybody didn't already know about, until I found Ann Putnam Jr.'s apology letter. You know, being the only one of the accusing girls to ever apologize for just what she had done. And then I started reading more and more into the story of her and what her life was like after the trial. And then it just started to develop this wonderful little tale of remorse and this sad case of a girl who was about 12 at the time and now being an adult in 1706. Her parents both died, having to raise her nine or ten siblings. And so it just started to unfold in my head what her day-to-day life must have been like, and that kind of became the story that I wanted to tell.
So Lines in the Dust is a graphic novel, and you're
yes.
both a writer and a visual artist. Did you know when you first got this idea that it was going to be a graphic novel?
No, initially, I was thinking of it as, and don't laugh, but a 32-page children's picture book, which is told in kind of a, you know, that was before I had kids. So now I realize the folly in having a picture book that ends in 24 deaths. Not a good idea. So then you know, a couple publishers had it in their hands, and then Island Port out of Maine said, well, what do you think about turning this into a graphic novel? And I said, well, you know, I could do that. So it just required, you know, a bunch more writing, a bunch more kind of script writing almost to develop the characters. The original draft was very much just a play on her letter, and then the graphic novel became kind of more of an in-depth look into what her life was possibly like at the time.
I don't think that I've seen many, if any, graphic novels about the witch trials.
No, there was an illustrated book, not really done in graphic novel form, that came out a few years ago. I believe Random House put it out, and the title's escaping me. But there really aren't. And the good thing about this is, you know, it's for today's kids, this is kind of the way that they're learning. There's a lot of history books being done in graphic novel format now. And I think this is, you know, you get the history out of it. Obviously, it's historical fiction, but, you know, using images is such a great way to have kids be interested in this when they can see it happening. Because who doesn't like to see it happening? You know, big people do, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I'm really interested in this apology letter from Ann Putnam because, mm-hmm. you know what, I'm having a vague recollection of hearing about it somewhere
yeah.
before, but that's not something widely publicized.
No, not at all. And, you know, as far as records show, she was the only of the girls, the accusing girls, to ever apologize. The rest of them seemed to kind of go off and live their lives and get married, but she didn't. And so, you know, this happened in 1692, the trials, and then by 1706, you know, the way that I'm looking at it is, in 1706, she's going to raise her entire family, and she is, I believe, 26 at the time now. I'm getting my math wrong. Anyhow, so she's also been kicked out of the church. You know, there's a new minister. They want nothing to do with her because of, you know, it was this great, horrible thing, this huge folly. And so I just started imagining, you know, what's it like when Ann Putnam leaves her home and goes to the store, you know? She is who she is, and they all know, and, you know, and she probably, you know, you go into the store, and the shopkeep could have been the brother of somebody who you had hanged. And so she writes this apology letter, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, she wrote it with the new reverend, and it's just the way that it's worded was so beautiful, and there were so many instances where, and the title Lies in the Dust comes from that. It's actually suggested by my editor, Melissa Kim at Island Port. My original title was The Apology of Ann Putnam Jr., and it's just so literal. But there's a point in the letter where she says, you know, I wish to lie in the dust for what I've done. And so she was admitted back to the Salem Church. She died somewhat shortly thereafter. She died pretty young. And but this letter is kind of was like the dangling thing in my view of what I was going to use as my Salem story.
You can hear my complete interview with Jacob on the Literary New England blog site, which is www.litnewengland.com. I've also posted some images from Lies in the Dust, which I think you'll really like, as I really like Jacob giving a shout out to my book about Connecticut's witch trials during our interview. So thank you, Jacob. That book, which was published last year by the History Press, is called Connecticut Witch Trials, First Panic in the New World. If you're a reader of the Literary New England blog or follow either me or Literary New England on Twitter, you know that I love writing about witch things, whether it's about Connecticut witch history, Salem witch history, or other related witch topics. But please go to litnewengland.com, take a look at Jacob Crane's Lies in the Dust, A Tale of Remorse from the Salem Witch Trials, and tell us what you think. Next month, a graphic novel about the Scarlet Letter is being published manga style, which I definitely can't wait to look at and talk about. ''73 Massachusetts is one of the two settings of Santa Montefiore's The Beekeeper's Daughter. It's the first book Santa has ever set in the United States, and it came at last after years of trepidation. I wondered why the wait and why the worry to finally tell a story set here.
I went to Nantucket years ago with some friends in 2000, and I was pregnant with my daughter, and I was so swept away by the beauty of the island, those clapboard houses with the grey shingled roofs and, oh, God, the widow's walks and the pretty colors, those pale grays and pale blues. And it was so beautiful. I thought, one day I'm going to write about this. And I never really had the confidence to write about it because I only went once. And although I've got a family friend who goes a lot to Nantucket, I think the parents have a house there and everything, and I, you know, hear lots of stories and things, I wasn't confident enough to write about it because I didn't know the place so well. And one has to be very careful if you're writing about a real place, because there are always people to write in and say, actually, that street isn't there, or that beach isn't like that. So it's sort of occurred to me to, if I made up my own island, I could base it on Nantucket, but I wouldn't be tied to the geography. So it was a long process. I'd always had it at the back of my mind. I'd so love to write about it. And then this time with The Beekeeper's Daughter, I wanted to have it based in America, a part of it. And I thought, okay, now I'm going to do it. So I did.
Well, good for you. I love it. So tell me, what is the story all about?
Okay, it's two parallel stories, a mother and a daughter. So the mother is called Grace, and you have her story during the war, the Second World War, in the countryside, in the English countryside. And she's the daughter of a beekeeper. And then you have her daughter's story in the 70s on this island called Tekanasset. And she's fallen in love with a wannabe rock star, and she's very rebellious, and she's a typical sort of 60s, 70s girl wanting to be independent and rebellious. And you have the shadow of her mother's love affair during the war with this man that she couldn't have. And it's really, they're two parallel stories. You go back and forth, and I don't want to spoil the storyline, but it's these two women's search for love, I suppose. And yeah, that's probably as much as I can say without spoiling the plot.
Well, we certainly don't want to spoil the plot. And actually, as we talk, I'm looking at your website, which has several different covers.
Yes.
Has two different covers of this new book, The Beekeeper's Daughter.
Yep.
And it's interesting to me, the UK cover is very Englishy looking.
Yes.
And the US
yes.
copy is very, very New Englandy.
Yes, well, I think, yes, you're right. The English have focused on the cottage in the countryside, and in the English countryside, and of course the Americans and the Dutch actually have also focused on the island, Tekanasset of Massachusetts, for their image, I suppose. You know, they're subjective. Although, I think for the English, what they love about it is the Tekanasset scenes. The English, we love exotic foreign scenes. I think probably the Americans would like the English scenes because it's different. But anyway,
we love all things English anyway. I think we're a country just obsessed with the British.
Well, I'm obsessed with the Americans. I love America. And actually, my husband, because we're both writers, our children are at school here, but we fantasize that one day when the children leave school, we're going to go and just live in America for a year. We'd love to do that.
Isn't that funny? Well, my husband and I fantasize about coming and living in London for
a year.
Well,
I think the weather's better where you are. Certainly in the summer. I think you can guarantee nice summers.
I guess so, huh? So The Beekeeper's Daughter, this is what, your 15th, 16th
it's book? My 15th book. I go with the years. So in 2015, I know my 15th is coming out. Actually, The Beekeeper's Daughter came out in hardback last year in England. So it's actually my 14th book. I have a new book coming out in the UK here, which is my 15th. So The Beekeeper's Daughter is actually my 15th book, yes.
So for people who have read you before Santa, will they see something new or different in The Beekeeper's Daughter?
I hope to give something different. Every book I write, I hope, is going to challenge me a little more. And they're all different, but they're all very much the same genre. So if you love one, you're not going to have to worry that you're not going to like this one. I've read various authors where I've fallen in love. For example, Fanny Flagg. I loved Fried Green Tomatoes at Whistle Stop Cafe, and I wanted with her next book the same thing. And I read Welcome to the girl, Welcome to the World, Baby Girl. And I did love that book, actually. But at the beginning, I was disappointed because it wasn't the same sort of thing. So, you know, I think I write a similar genre, certainly with the books, the last 15 books. My new trilogy in Ireland is different, but certainly the books that I've written up till now are all a similar genre. So if you like one, I think you'll like them all, but I hope it delivers something different as well.
So do we see something of you in your book?
I don't think I can separate myself from my characters. And there's a part of me in Trixie, and there's a part of me in Grace, and I think also sometimes there are parts of me in the men as well, in maybe their philosophies or the way they think. I put myself into everything. Also, I think as human beings, there are silent parts of us that remain in the shadows, and sometimes those parts never come out. Maybe it would take another relationship to bring that side of us out, and it never happens. But with me and my writing, I can live vicariously through my characters, and I can live in a way that maybe I'd like to live but don't, if you see what I mean. So I can explore these different parts of myself through my characters. I mean, I'm not like Trixie at all. I was never rebellious. I was really well-behaved, always growing up. And with Trixie, maybe I can be somebody slightly different. So for me, in a way, it's a fantasy when I write.
And so certainly the setting you had mentioned to us came from your visit here to New England several years ago.
Yeah.
What about the storyline itself before you married your wonderful husband, who is a writer
who
you're in love with a rock singer?
Do you know, I never know, but weirdly, it sounds so strange, but I will put out a little word before I write my books, because I often need help with my books and research and things. And I was thinking about writing this sort of rock star bit, and I thought, I don't know any rock stars. Please, you know, up there, anybody, just guide me to where I can get some research. And then that night I sat next to Bob Geldof at dinner. I mean, how weird is that?
Oh, get out of here.
Yes, and he was starting up as a rock star in the early 70s. And I said to him, I said, this is so strange. You've been delivered to me on a plate this evening. And he was absolutely charming. So I can't remember what the question was now, because I've digressed. own life.
You love the rock star, yes.
Yeah, no, do you know, I think most of my books, they're always going to be aspects of my life. Certainly, I grew up in Hampshire, in the English countryside. My father's a farmer. I had a totally idyllic upbringing in the most beautiful place with bluebell woods and a 17th century, really beautiful Jacobean house. So a lot of the scenes, the English scenes, certainly in The Beekeeper, are very much based on my own upbringing, and I can see the farm in my head and the tracks through the woods and the light, and, you know, the feel of the place is very much derivative of my upbringing. But I think the storylines, my life was very boring by comparison, and if I was to put my life into a book, I think people would fall asleep within the first page.
I have to imagine. So did you send Bob Geldof an autographed copy?
Do you know, I haven't actually. I don't know whether, he just doesn't seem to be the sort of person that would enjoy my books. I think he's, I don't know, I just don't think he's my reader. So no, I haven't actually. But certainly if I see him again, I'll say thank you, because it's been number one on the bestsellers list here. So I actually really should say thank you.
That's fabulous. And now, any plans at all to come to the U.S.?
Well, do you know, I would really love that. The last time I went on book tour was about 5-6 years ago, so it would be such fun to go on book tour again. I've got nothing planned. I'm due to go to Australia at some point, in South Africa, but America's always the big one for me. You know, it's what everybody wants. We all want success in America. And I love the Americans. And last time I traveled around, I went to Kansas City and Milwaukee. And I went to really fun places. And actually, I've made friends in all those places. And I still email and, you know, we keep in touch. So I pick up friends wherever I go. So I love the idea of going back to America and revisiting those places and seeing my old friends. I'd love to do that.
Well, maybe next summer, if not this summer, you can go to the Nantucket Book Festival.
Oh, wouldn't that be fabulous? I'd love to do that.
Yeah,
any excuse to go back to Nantucket.
Event.
I'd love that.
Oh, it is. It really is a very magical place, and it has inspired so many different writers.
Yes.
Is it place that inspires you?
I always think of the place first, funnily enough. Before I start writing, I think, where do I want to go? Because for me, I'm going to be spending 6 months somewhere, and I want to enjoy it. So, and also, I think if you really enjoy what you're doing, you sort of open up there's something in you that opens up and the creativity just flows through you. You're really enjoying it. At first, that's what inspiration is. And so I have to love what I'm writing. I have to love where I am, and I've got to really feel that I'm there. I want to smell it, hear it, feel it. And so Nantucket, for me, with the beautiful gardens, the smells, the sea, I mean, it was just so evocative. And I bought this book, this big hardback book on Nantucket. So I had all the pictures of those lovely houses, the interiors, the gardens, and all. It was very well written. It's a beautiful book. I can't remember what it's called. But and that was inspiring, too. So it, for me, it was just a heavenly thing to find myself in Nantucket for 6 months in my imagination.
You mentioned how you have to live with the character for, or you have to live with the place for 6 months. Is that how long it takes you to write a book?
Yes, I generally, I start thinking about it probably about 6 months before I start writing. I'm already writing one book, and as I'm coming to the end of that book, I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to do next? And so I finish a book in July. I have the summer off. Then I have to sort of edit the book because it comes back from my editor, sort of, which is September, October. And then I finish, and I have really October, December before I start writing the new one in January, and I have to hand it in July. So from January to July, I'm really head down and writing pretty much every day and very involved in the book. Obviously, it depends how much research I have to do, but on the whole, with Beekeeper's Daughter, I didn't have to do an enormous amount of research. So I could start in January and go through to July. And yes, I sit with my characters and my location. I put my music on. I light my scented candles. And I just disappear into my imagination. It's a heavenly thing to do.
It sounds like you have it down to a science.
Well, I think I'm now doing my 16th book. So, yeah, I think I know my trade now. I know how it works.
And Santa, we need to wrap things up, but why should someone pick up a copy of The Beekeeper's Daughter?
I think because life is tough. Life is hard. We all have our difficulties. We open the papers or listen to the news every day, and it's pretty miserable. I think we all need an escape. We all need to feel love. We want to take ourselves to beautiful places where we can breathe the sort of sugar-scented air and look at the stunning views and feel nature and feel the expansion within us and just take ourselves off somewhere that is not material, you know, somewhere that inspires our senses and makes us feel good. And I hope
Santa,
that's what my books deliver.
I am so ready to go.
Good. Well, if you read it, I hope it transports you too.
Well, thank you so much for talking
with us. It's a pleasure, and thank you very much for calling me. It's lovely to speak to you.
Win a copy of The Beekeeper's Daughter by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. You can do the same thing to win a copy of An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir. The young adult novel released at the very end of last month that has become an instant New York Times bestseller is now listed as Amazon's very best book of May and has received all kinds of stellar reviews from The Washington Post, Publishers Weekly, The New York Times Review of Books, and just about everyone, with many reviewers likening Saba to J.K. Rowling, George R.R. Martin, and Suzanne Collins. Praise that I imagine must be overwhelming for a debut novelist.
It's really wonderful. I'm really thankful because I didn't expect when I, you know, even started writing the book, when I finished the book, I didn't expect such a reception. I just really wanted to get it published. And I wasn't sure, you know, how. So it's just been wonderful. I feel really lucky.
So tell us about the story, please.
Sure. So An Ember in the Ashes is a young adult fantasy, and it's about two people. It's about a girl named Laya who is fighting for her family and a soldier named Elias who's fighting for his freedom. Laya and Elias live under a brutal military empire called the Martial Empire where any sort of defiance is, you know, basically met with death. And in this place, Laya's brother is taken from her, her older brother, and he's thrown into prison and accused of treason, which is basically a death sentence. So she has to get him back. She's trying to save him. But the problem is she's not very brave. And in order to save him, you know, she has to find her courage. Elias, meanwhile, is a soldier of the Martial Empire. And he is a student at Blackcliff Academy, a place where the marshals train their most, you know, vicious soldiers. Mm-hmm. And he just doesn't want to be a soldier anymore. He really wants to find his freedom. But before he can, he's ordered to participate in a series of trials, which will determine the identity of the next Martial Empire, Emperor. So, you know, it's a life and death battle for him. And when these two characters meet, they realize their fates are intertwined and that their choices are going to change the fate of the empire itself. That's about some of it.
So where did this story come from?
It came from a couple of things. So the first is that I grew up in this really sort of isolated town in the Mojave Desert, and I didn't feel like I fit in. I was picked on. I watched my parents and my family deal with just a lot of, you know, racism. So I felt really like an outcast. I felt like, you know, I didn't have any power as a kid. And I turned to books to deal with that feeling, particularly fantasy, which is, you know, in the end why I wrote a fantasy book. As I grew, you know, I did find my power and my voice through writing. And in 2007, I decided, you know what, I want to write a book. And I didn't know, you know, what genre it would be or what it would really be about. I just knew it would be about people who felt like outcasts, like I did as a kid, and who felt like they didn't have any power or voice. People who felt stifled, you know. And at the time, I was working as a copy editor at the Washington Post, and I was reading about some really voiceless people, you know, people who were completely isolated, and who, you know, had no choice in sort of the lot in life that they'd been given. That was, you know, I read about everything from like the Sudanese genocide to extrajudicial jailings in Kashmir, child soldiers, you know, in the DRC and Colombia, and it all combined to sort of plant the seed for Ember.
So I know it says in your bio that your family owned an 18-room motel in the desert. I can't help but think that you saw quite a few characters go through there.
Oh, yes. I saw some very, very interesting characters. We had a guy who once paid us with a parakeet because he loved birds and had all these birds. I still remember very clearly one guy who really wanted to find his ex, and he was abusive. So she had asked us not to tell him where, you know, where she was and in the motel. And this guy threatened my mother, and he was, you know, yelling at her and threatening to, like, try to come in the motel. And I remember being really afraid. And my mom was absolutely fearless. I mean, she's tiny. She's, you know, I don't know, 5'3 or so. But she took a broom and she went out and she faced off with him. So because she was worried for us, she didn't want us to be afraid. And she was completely fearless. And, you know, those are some of the stories I remember from the motel.
Oh, my goodness. And so do we see anyone in Ember in the Ashes trying to pay off a debt with a bird or, protecting her young with a broom?
We don't see any sort of direct stories from the motel, but I definitely have female characters who I think reflect my mother's strengths.
That's great. And, I mean, one of the things that impresses me about Ember in the Ashes and that really amazes me about fantasy books, so many of them, is that you guys have created entire worlds. Like, you didn't just create a couple of characters. You created an entire world. And actually, you have a gorgeous website, an emberintheashesbook.com, where you really can go explore that world. I mean, there's videos and maps and, you know, character profiles, and I'm just, like, blown away. Did you develop some of this stuff as part of the writing process?
While I was writing, I developed the world, and I found a ton of imagery that inspired me. I listened to a lot of music that inspired me, but the biggest thing that I did in the hopes of building a world that was complete was I researched. I was inspired by the Julio-Claudian era of ancient Rome. That's really sort of what Ember is inspired by. So, and then I was also inspired by the ancient Spartan agoge, which was a system that the Spartans used to train their young boys into basically super soldiers. And then the magical mythology comes from stories that my mom told me when I was a kid. you know, she would tell me stories of jinn and, you know, other sort of mystical creatures, and that stuck in my head for years. So, you know, and then the setting of the book itself comes from where I grew up. I grew up in the desert, and it's a very, a place that's very stark, but it's also very beautiful. So I use my memories of the land to sort of help me detail the physical setting of Ember.
So Blackcliff Academy may be in a stark desert, but I'll tell you, it sounds like a New England boarding school.
Oh, yeah. Maybe without the murder and the killing.
Well, I don't know. There could be that going on, too. It wouldn't be the first time. So a lot of the comparisons, Ember in the Ashes is compared to Game of Thrones. How do you feel about that?
I mean, all I can feel is just utter delight. You know, I love Game of Thrones. So I just feel really excited and happy that anyone would make that comparison. It's such a high compliment.
So now, who have been some of your inspirations as far as authors go? Is there anyone or one author or several that you've kind of modeled your own writing after?
I don't know about modeling my own writing. I did have authors who really inspired me. The Sword of Shannara by Terry Brooks was a big inspiration. It was my gateway book into fantasy. And then The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. I read that and sort of realized, oh, look, you know, there's a South Asian who's writing. There's sort of this joke among South Asians that, you know, an entire group of girls who would have been otherwise doctors read that book and they were like, hey, I can be a writer instead. And then the Harry Potter books by J.K. Rowling, I read them when I was a little bit older, but just her plotting is just so incredibly tight and her imagination is wonderful. And so those were definitely a big inspiration.
So an Ember in the Ashes, is it a standalone book or are there more to come?
So right now Ember is a standalone, but I do have, you know, really high hopes for a sequel.
And you are on a tour for An Ember in the Ashes. What is it like to meet with your readers?
It is the best thing. I met with the students at a middle school in Salt Lake City, and a lot of them had read the book, and it was so exciting to hear their questions and to see how much they cared about these characters and how curious they were, you know, about what's going to happen in the future and, you know, why did this character do this? And it's just been very, very wonderful. I have absolutely nothing to complain about. It's been great to meet them.
And I know that you're coming to New York, which is on the East Coast, but you're not coming to New England. How come?
So my publicist made the tour stops for me. She sort of decided what she wanted me to do this time around. But I have two little kids, so I can't spend too much time on the road.
Yeah.
Because I need to get back to the little guys. So.
Gotcha. Well, the next time you look at going out, you have to look to come to Boston or Connecticut or New Hampshire or somewhere around this area.
I would love to. I have a dear friend in Boston, and, you know, it was killing me that I couldn't go and, you know, and do an event there because she had said that the book community was wonderful, and I've heard the same about, you know, much of New England, so I would really, really love to come there.
And perhaps I am being very presumptuous, and certainly tell me if I am wrong, but I would have to think that at some part of your life you read some Stephen King, and he might have had some influence on you.
You know, I was always too afraid to read Stephen King.
Oh, no!
But I did read, I read one of his books as a kid, and it terrified me. It was The Shining. I think that's the one, or I can't remember now, but I do love a Stephen King's book on writing. That was incredibly influential for me. It really helped me. It's like one of my top five, you know, writing books about writing.
So I have to tell you, I read The Shining as an adult, and it is hands down the scariest book I ever read.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't sleep in my own house. It was ridiculous. I was this, you know, 40-something-year-old woman lying in bed, jumping at every sound I heard outside. It was nuts.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not alone. I don't think I am. I know a lot of people who are terrified of that stuff.
Right?
Yeah.
So, An Ember in the Ashes, it certainly seems that even though it's a YA book, that it has huge crossover appeal and that adults are reading it and loving it as well.
I have heard from a lot of adults, and it's really wonderful that they're so excited about the book. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, when you write YA, you have to tell the truth. Even if you're writing a fantasy world, your world has to feel true. The characters have to feel true because young adult readers are very, very astute, and they will sort of they will know if you're lying to them or if you're painting a picture that's not realistic. And I really do believe that anyone of any age, you know, the truth and honesty in writing appeals to them.
So is there something that you want people to close the last page of An Ember in the Ashes and realize that they felt or experienced?
I guess that, you know, it may not always feel like it, but hope is just such a powerful force, and it's more powerful than hatred or than fear. And we can almost always find a reason to hope. You know, do we have the strength to do so in truly difficult times? My belief is yes, no matter how weak you might think you are or how bad, you know, your situation, I do think that we all have the strength inside us to hope. And I do believe that hope is for strong people, not for naive people, you know.
Saba, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the conversation.
I loved talking with Kate Bullock about her memoir, Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate is a journalist, like me, and I love talking with fellow female journalists. I also love her book, The Pioneering Woman Writers, whose story she includes, The Idea of Taking Ownership of Your Desires and Living Authentically. But maybe most of all, more than anything else, what I love is that along with this book, you can get paper dolls of Edith Wharton, Neith Boyce, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and the other women who are featured in the book. So I wanted to talk about that first and where the brilliant ideas for these most awesome and inspiring toys came from.
It's the marketing department at Crown. They're brilliant, and they came up with this idea and did an unbelievable job with them. I think that they're perfect.
They are perfect. Now, have you cut them out, and do you have them, like, around your office or something?
Oh, I wish. I actually haven't had to. I've been running around doing this book tour and haven't even had time to like really sit down with the paper dolls. No, but I look forward to it. I think I want to frame all of them is my plan.
Oh my God, you have to.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Aren't they incredible? And the quotes they chose are perfect. And they also came up with this whole other bigger media kit with cocktails and questions, you know, for a book club. It's so cool. And each cocktail is tailored to the personality of the woman. And I love how they let me go back and forth a little bit with helping with the artist to figure out what the outfits and accessories should be for each woman. So I love how personally tailored they are to each.
What a ball.
Yeah.
This whole experience of writing this book and the reception that it's received and what I think has just become a bit of a phenomena. I mean, it has to be crazy fun and also a little bit surreal at the same time.
Oh, it is. It's overwhelming. Because, you know, I spent a good 2 years just sitting in my office writing this book. It's so solitary. And then to go into public with it is, and especially here in the day and age of social media, when you are hearing from readers over Twitter and Facebook and email. So it's even more public feeling than ever before, I would think, for an author.
So let's talk a bit about Spinster. Whenever you see a quick blurb about what Spinster is, it's the book that evolved out of the article that you wrote for The Atlantic. Is it as simple as that?
No, not at all. So I think of it, in a sense, as a prelude to that Atlantic article, because these were women I had been thinking about and reading and researching about as a hobby, really, for the past 15 years. And when I wrote that Atlantic article, that, you know, the assignment was to look at changing contemporary attitudes around marriage and trends around marriage. And while I was researching and reporting that article, I started to think a lot about the women I had been thinking about for so long, who I write about in the book, who, you know, and I was drawn to them for the ways in which they had thought about marriage versus not marriage in their own lives and written about these issues and lived unconventionally. So after the Atlantic article came out and there was such a big response to that, I decided that for a book, I rather than turn that article into a book, which is what a lot of publishers were interested in, and I think that would make a very interesting book, but for me personally, I felt like I was done with it journalistically, and I wanted to take this historic, literary, more reflective, ruminative approach and take advantage of what a book offers, which is an intimacy with the reader that a magazine article can't do quite. And so I wanted to do with the book, I wanted to, you know, try to capture this imaginary relationship I have with these five women who I'd been thinking about for the past 15, in some cases longer, years and more, and put that experience on the page and bring a new way of thinking and talking about these issues around choices and show that the contemporary conversation around marriage that feels so new and contemporary is in fact quite old and has been going on in public for at least 150 years.
So you weave your story around those of five very different and very distinct women. Can you tell us just a little bit about each of them and what it was that attracted you particularly to them?
Yeah, sure. So I'll tell you about it in order of how I found them or how they came to me in life. The first is Maeve Brennan, who was an essayist and short story writer for The New Yorker at mid-century, who came from Ireland and lived alone for basically her whole life and wrote. Her writing is some of the most lasting writing for me. She wrote in the most singular way, you know, in the urban flaneur tradition, roaming around the city, observing what she saw. But living as a woman alone at mid-century America, which was, in my opinion, second only to the Salem witch trials in being a terrible time to be a single woman in this country. Next was Neith Boyce, who I came across in the year 2000 and was stunned to find a column that she had written for Vogue in the year 1898 called The Bachelor Girl about her decision to never marry. So she was my entree to that period in time, Greenwich Village Bohemia, and the public critique around marriage that was going on then that I had not known anything about until I found Neith. And then next is Edna St. Vincent Millay, whose poetry I had loved reading as a girl and who, as a young girl, I mean, and who was, you know, America's most famous single person, a single female icon in the early 1900s, and wrote with, you know, great audacity and lyricism and humor about casual love, basically, or casual sex, as we would think of it today. But in her case, it was a very passionate, she's a very passionate woman, but not at all bound in by convention. And so she unlocked her own readership at a time when women were really ready to hear that kind of voice in the early 1900s, and also spoke to me across the century. I found a lot to learn from her. And then Edith Wharton, who I loved since college, is when I first started reading her novels. And I'd always thought of her as this grande dame, very, you know, privileged, wealthy, someone I could never or didn't even want to identify with on a personal level. I was very happy to revere her as a novelist and as a great and brilliant mind. And then I was surprised to kind of have more of a personal attraction to her when, by the time I hit my early 30s or mid-30s, I guess, I was working for a home decor magazine and discovered that Edith Wharton's first book was a home decorating manual, which was the most influential decorating manual of the turn of the last century. And that's what brought me to The Mount, which is her, you know, she designed it soup to nuts herself. the architecture and the decor. And she was a radical figure in terms of how we think about the home, because she was bringing European ideas to these shores and determining what good taste is. And her ideas about good taste last now, even. You know, she set a template that people still adhere to. And what she was concerned with were ideas around scale and proportion and light, bringing the outdoors in, all kinds of stuff that we associate with the high modernists. And in fact, you know, here she was, this Victorian and late Victorian woman, bringing these very new and interesting ideas to us. And she also, for me, the more I got to become, the more I came to learn about her architectural and decorative ideas, the more I came to see that she thought of these things as metaphors for how to live, the, you know, best practices for living, about scale and proportion, not only architecturally, but also in how you balance your day, how you spend time, how you integrate the need for solitude with the need for socializing, with meaningful work. And so although she was doing that from a very high place, she came from money, she made a ton of money, I still find a lot of her ideas applicable to anyone, whether or not you have money. So that was exciting to me to realize. And then the last is Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was the oldest of the five women I write about, and so far she was born in 1860, versus Maeve Brennan, who was born in 1917. And Charlotte Perkins Gilman, you know, she was a feminist writer and activist in the late 1800s and early 1900s, an incredibly industrious, prolific writer who was intent, hell-bent on bringing her ideas about how to make women's lives better to the masses. She was, you know, really, she spent 10 years on her own traveling around the country speaking. And so I find her to be a very inspiring figure in the ways in which she thought so deliberately and intentionally about how she lived her life. She, in, as a teenager, she swore off marriage. She decided she had much bigger fish to fry. She wanted to change the world. She didn't have time to be with just one person and devote herself to domestic concerns. And that was really the only mistake she ever made, was getting married, and quickly got pregnant and had a child, and then, you know, sank into the most famous postpartum depression in American letters, which was immortalized by her short story, The Yellow Wallpaper, and left her husband and, you know, to much public outcry, because at that point she was a public figure and people were scandalized by the idea of a woman leaving her husband, living on her own, leaving her child, really. She had co-custody of her daughter. And for me, she tied together all the themes that have concerned me for so long, that each of the women I write about in the book touches on or exemplifies in one way or another. But Charlotte brings them all together. The question of how do we balance autonomy, the needs for autonomy with the needs for intimacy? How do we think about the home as a place that gives us comfort but doesn't imprison us? How to live as a woman in the world on her own terms. She likes to call herself, quote-unquote, a woman at large, and that was her way of describing those 10 years that she traveled around on the speaking circuit, bringing her ideas to the people.
Kate, I imagine that in many respects it was a difficult book to write, and certainly this is just me assuming. I mean, there's the length aspect, even though you've written some long pieces, certainly a book is much longer. But it also required so much more than journalism does, right? I mean, this is a very deeply personal book. You really had to get introspective. Was the whole process, you know, talking both about the structure and the content, was it difficult for you?
Oh my gosh, it was absolutely the most difficult thing I've ever done. It was so hard from start to finish on every level. Yeah, writing at book length is so different than journalism, which I've been doing for so long and I'm so practiced at this point. And so I think of it as writing a book versus writing a magazine article is like wading into the ocean versus stepping into a swimming pool. So a magazine article, you know the word length, you know how deep you can go, basically. With a book, you're wading into the ocean. You could go anywhere. You don't know when the undertow is going to come and grab your ankles and pull you under. You don't know when the floor is going to drop off and suddenly you'll be over your head. So that, just conceptually, getting accustomed to the liberty that of a book was really terrifying, actually. And, you know, once I got into it, it felt very fun and liberating, but it was hard and scary at first. And then the amount of historical research I had to do, you know, because I had been thinking about these women and reading their works and biographies for so long, but just as a hobbyist. So to sit down and really think about them deeply and get the facts right on the page was very hard. I think it's easy to overlook how difficult historical research is to some degree, just getting the facts right, because to write a sentence like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of some kind of, you know, Edna St. Vincent Millay's house, you know, on the bay. And then you have to pause and think, well, wait, was it actually on the bay or was it further back in town? You know, those kinds of just getting everything right. And then, yes, to be bringing in my own personal story required a kind of, this, you know, psychological reckoning, or, you know, coming to terms with and thinking about myself in a way that I could then deliver in a book was tricky and strange, and it too required a kind of historical research. You know, I went back into my diaries and letters from the period just to remember, you know, to start out as, who was I when I was a young woman in my 20s, thinking about how my life would go, and so to revisit that self was surprising too. It ended up being more personal than I had expected it to be in the book. I had intended to be more of a sort of at arm's length narrator guiding you through these women, and then realized that was no good, that in order to really feel my relationships with the women, you had to know a lot more about me than I had originally intended.
Which makes you very vulnerable, but it seems that vulnerability that you put forth in the book is really what people are connecting to. In fact, I would go so far as to say, and you can certainly tell me if you think I'm wrong, that, you know, it's your story, it's your willingness to put yourself out there and then weave in all these other women in the context of all of your lives, because you talk about the facts, but what makes all of those facts really pop and become meaningful are the context of each of the eras. And it's so surprising, well, I guess it's not as surprising as I would like it to be, that even today, the idea of spinsterhood is so radical.
Right, I know, isn't it surprising? there's so much that surprises me about I was focusing mostly on the turn of the last century. That's where I was trying to ground the book. And that was for several reasons. One, there's so much interesting to be said about single women in America during the colonial period, during the Salem witch trials, during the early 1800s, when there was what historians call the cult of single blessedness, when women like Louisa May Alcott were consciously rejecting marriage. There's so much to do, but I felt like too broad a survey would be too bewildering for a reader, that I had to locate the book, kind of anchor it by a time period. And that was a no-brainer to make it be the turn of the last century, because for me that had been such an exciting and pivotal intellectual discovery to learn about Greenwich Village, Bohemia, and the conversations and unconventional ways of thinking and living that had been going on then. And so I had been repeatedly drawn to that time period in my reading over the course of these last 15 years, but it really wasn't until I started to do the research for the book that I came to understand why, and came to see the surprising similarities between that time period and our time period. So here we are, a century on, everything looks different. We talk differently about marriage. Marriage itself is a very different institution than it was 100 years ago. But the fact that women were flooding the workforce and universities in unprecedented numbers is parallel to today. So we today are experiencing changes that have been in the works for 200 years, for 40 years. You know, this is a long story in the making about the opportunities and advantages that women have today. It's not a new story, but it's feeling new because of the numbers, because now we have, you know, 53% of women over the age of 18 are unmarried. We've never had so many unmarried women at once. And so because of that, there's a similarity to the fact that during the late 1800s, that was the first time we'd had so many unmarried women living on their own, working on their own. So the struggles and challenges those women were dealing with then are similar to now. It's almost, I think of them as the prototypes of the single women of today. They were the beginning of who I am now. And the word spinster itself, I chose it as the title of the book because I think it brilliantly broadcasts our weird, archaic ideas around single women, and that there's still a discomfort around it, that we're still threatened by single women, that there's still, it's lessening, but there's still some stigma around it, certainly that a lot of women feel internally. And that, you know, who would think, here we are in the year 2015. It doesn't seem to make any sense. And so I think it's really interesting to think about and explore why that is.
Do you think that stigma is something that will ever go away?
I think it will. I think it might take a while. I think that as long as we're still in a place where we're ostensibly celebrating the wife and mother as the default and best possible roles for women. And the reason I say ostensibly is because we, culturally, that's what we tell women to do, but we still don't support the working mother the way that other countries do. So it's a kind of false celebration to some degree. But anyway, as long as we are telling women that they should get married and be mothers, and that's the reason for being, I think that the single woman, the specter of the single woman is still going to be misunderstood and marginalized. But there, you know, that conversation is changing, and so much is changing so quickly with assisted reproductive technologies and the stigmas lessening around single mothers. So I'm hopeful. I see a lot of change. I just don't know how long it will take.
Kate, we're running out of time here, but I want to make sure that we talk about this wonderful event that you have coming up on May 15th at the Mount.
Yes, I'm so excited. I love the Mount from like roof to floor, and the people who work at the Mount are such lovely people. It's been so lovely working with them. So, so I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll be talking about what Edith Wharton meant to me and, you know, in the very place that I really came to Edith Wharton to really where I came to understand and commune with her, you know, the Mount itself. So I think it will be a really special night, an unusual kind of book event.
That's fabulous. And so that's going to be Friday, May 15th from 5 to 7 o'clock at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts. This is kind of a random question, but did you like sleep there to try to like breathe her in or anything like that?
I wish. I think that there are insurance codes or whatever that it makes it impossible. But I did in the year, I think it was 2007, I wrote a piece for Slate about Mount and brought a photographer friend. And so we spent a weekend while she photographed the place, and I just prowled around being there by day. But I did take a nap on the sofa.
Oh, good for you.
and then this last January, I spent a week at the Mount as a writer in residence. So I had all day to myself roaming around the place with my computer. And I think some napping was done then, but I couldn't spend the night there.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. That's too bad. But I think the napping is key, right? Because our subconscious is working and the energy around us is kind of, you know, coming in. And I don't know. I think it's really important when you're going to write about someone from history, if you have that opportunity to be and to sleep and to breathe their air, yes, it just amazing things happen.
Absolutely. And really, and just that week I spent there, just spending entire days in her place really brought me to a different and deeper understanding of who she was as a thinker and a person. It's so special and different, and there really is no other place like it as far as, you know, a physical space designed by an American author that still exists that the public can be part of. It's a real treasure.
And my last question to you is I imagine there is a misconception that Spinster is just a book for women.
Oh, yes, yes. I've been hearing really interesting responses from male readers and who are seeing themselves in the book, which surprises me, actually. I mean, I wasn't expecting to have male readers. I wanted this to be a book for all women, whether single or married. I think that it's useful is potentially useful in so far as giving readers new ways to think about the shape and scope and possibilities of our lives. And it's been so heartening to hear from men who are getting something out of it as well.
That's awesome. Kate, yes, Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I have a copy of Spinster to give away to you, which you can win by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. There's actually still time for you to win all of the books featured in this podcast if you send us an email or a tweet right now. I'm going to make sure that I tweet a big thank you to the great guests featured tonight. I'm also going to thank them here, so thanks Kate, Santa, Saba, and Jacob. Thanks also to you for listening. Be sure to click over on to LitNewEngland.com to hear my entire interview with Jacob Crane about Lies in the Dust, A Tale of Remorse from the Salem Witch Trials. Also, make a point of checking back regularly to our blog site, and you'll see all kinds of neat promos and giveaways, including a giveaway of Laura Anderson's new novel, The Virgin's Daughter. I'm going to do that tomorrow, Tuesday, May 12th. If you're a Tudor fan, you're hopefully already a fan of Laura's Boleyn King trilogy, which is an alternate telling of the Tudor reign, where Laura imagines that instead of Anne Boleyn miscarrying her and King Henry's son, she actually gives birth to him, and he becomes King William. Laura's new series is called the Tudor Legacy Trilogy, in which she reimagines history so that Elizabeth I gives birth to a legitimate heir. I loved the Boleyn King trilogy and can't wait to sink my teeth into this new series. And since I have two copies of The Virgin's Daughter, I thought it might be fun if a literary New England fan sunk their time and reading energy into a copy with me. I'll post the details tomorrow about how you can be that fan and win a copy of The Virgin's Daughter. Check back at www.litnewengland.com tomorrow for all the details. That's it for tonight's Literary New England Radio Show. We'll be back again next week. Until then, I hope you have a great week and great reading.